You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
How are you feeling after that, Matt?
I feel a lot better than Bob.
Extra Time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Get lost. Get lost.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental from my apartment in Bed-Stuy. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Charlie Davies, and two Yopstams. No, I'm just kidding. That's Matt Doyle and David Goss. Happy Memorial Day. What's up, guys? How you feeling? How you doing? I get you confused. Bald guys, it's tough.
Yikes, dude. Just coming out firing. Wow.
Oh, boy.
Well, I showed my brother, who's not a soccer person at all, like I showed him Extra Time because he's like, I don't even know what you do for your job. And this was over Christmas. And so it was an old video of, it was you and me. It was three of us, not you, Charlie. It was three of us just on the old Extra Time set at the studio. And me and David were sitting next to each other. And he just kept pointing at David, pointing at David. It's like, is this a cousin? So apparently, we do look alike. I don't know. It's tough to tell us apart.
It's that Phoenician blood.
Yeah, exactly. You get it.
So happy Memorial Day, folks. Our thoughts go out to everybody who has served, also families and friends who've lost loved ones. Hope you're enjoying this day despite the times. You know. We are still in a pandemic, so I would just throw it out every single time we do this show. It goes unspoken. Thank you to all the people doing the work that's necessary to keep our society going. All the essential workers, all the people in the hospitals, the nurses, the doctors, the people cleaning, the people making food, the people doing the myriad of jobs that are to be done. Before we jump in, we have the greatest team of all time bracket. We're down to 8 teams. We'll bring it down to 6 teams today. So 2 eliminated. Do some eulogies for those teams. Dead in our bracket, but never dead in our hearts. Quick news, Liga MX canceled the Clausura season. So if you're looking around the soccer world and wondering who's going to play and when, well, for now, Mexico has walked away from the Clausura, which I think makes sense given where we are and everything that's happening. The Bundesliga is still going, obviously. I'm watching the games. I did enjoy the crowd noise this week. It made sense to me. It made me feel like I was watching the games that I used to watch, but also watching Alfonso Davies. Wow. Just wow. Even an empty stadium, that's incredible. Tyler Adams got on the field this week as a 6. Do you guys watch soccer? Are you enjoying watching soccer in that way? Does it still feel weird? Or have you come to terms with where it's at, where the Bundesliga is at, and honestly, where we'll all be at? Because soccer fans and stadiums probably aren't coming back anytime soon.
I mean, to me, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, because obviously, if you have a great atmosphere, playoff-type atmosphere, that's huge. But just to have live soccer back... I've watched just about every game over the past 2 weeks. It has brought me an unusual amount of joy, even though most of the U.S. players have struggled. And it's been like there are things to take from it. It's a different type of game because there's rust and because of the 5-sub rule. So I think we're seeing teams. Because of that rust, a disproportionate amount of games are being decided by mistakes, like the Hoffenheim Paderborn game. Everything Schalke has done is being decided by like self-inflicted mistakes right now. So it's been interesting to watch and analyze from that. And then the 5-sub rule, we haven't seen teams really take advantage of it yet, but Cologne, however you want to say it, in their game yesterday, they subbed 3 guys right at the 59th minute. And granted, they immediately gave up a goal on a counterattack and went down 2-0. But though, like using that many subs that early changed the entire feeling of that game. It was really interesting to watch. I think if you get out ahead of it, if you're a first mover as a coach, there's a competitive advantage baked into this. And I think we're going to see teams be a little bit more experimental with this over the next couple of weeks in the Bundesliga. And that's something that I think MLS coaches should be aware of for when our league comes back.
Charlie, as a player, when you see that 5-sub rule, how do you think about maybe how you would have been utilized differently, how coaches would have looked at their squads differently? How will it change things? Might it change things?
It's tough for a striker because normally your time is precious. If you don't score a goal in, let's say, 65, 70 minutes, your number's called. Maybe teams will say, now you have 50 minutes to get the job done. Press higher, play harder, so I can take you out sooner. You know, so there'll be more of, more pressure on these strikers to score early and play at a high level, high volume, and make a crazy number of sprints in the first 50 minutes of the game, knowing that we have five subs. I can take you off now. Like, I don't have to think about, man, do I keep him in until the 70th minute, 75th minute? I think you're going to see, the higher volume sprints, runs, there's going to be more action in the early parts of the game, knowing that you can change these guys out.
I would say also Doyle mentioned the rust. I think last week was a huge factor, but in 1 week, I think you've seen an upgrade and you can see how quickly teams that are already, you know, in season shape can change. I watched the Berlin Derby on Friday compared to, and maybe this is on Schalke again, another outlier, compared to that Derby, it was like night and day in terms of intensity, in terms of the focus in the teams. So I think you're going to see, obviously this will apply to MLS as well, I think, how quickly it comes back. And it will take a minute, but it's not like preseason where it's 6 weeks for strides. Like, it's 4 or 5 days. The other thing is, if you do silly things with no crowd, it's really embarrassing. Like, if you take a dive in a corner kick situation where you're like, oh, he pushed me, and there's no crowd cheering, you just look pathetic. So there's some moments where you can really key in on guys in this.
So beware is what you're saying. Of course, we're all following the news, trying to figure out what might happen with MLS and a return to play. We have nothing new for you at this time. Just continue to follow MLSsoccer.com and all the news that's breaking around that. Let's get to the greatest team of all time bracket. We're getting your thoughts on this, your votes. You made your opinion known, let's say. And I think the favorite in this whole thing is probably 2017 Toronto FC. They're facing off against the 3-seed 2010 Real Salt Lake over in the TAM region. And it wasn't even close, according to the fan vote. 72% went for Toronto. And then you had 27% coming in for 2010 RSL, which feels like probably RSL fans just trying to make sure they didn't get shut out on that one. Great team. But we're going to go Toronto here. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty obvious. Anybody? Yeah. Okay.
I don't want to leave it up for debate.
So let's like, you know, 2010 RSL doesn't deserve to go out like this with silence, with no, you know, memorial, with nothing. So let's think back on not just that team, but those RSL teams and what they meant to Major League Soccer at the time. And Doyle, I'll let or whoever wants to. I heard.
No, I would
jump
say
in.
For Doyle, I think we talked about this a few weeks ago, Doyle, off the show.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit about what that RSL team, from the way they chose to play, did for Major League Soccer. And then you knocked it on to what KC kind of responded with and the way tactics have changed and the league has changed.
Yeah, I actually kind of think that the league owes a debt to Jason Kreis and Peter Vermees for what they were able to build. Like, this RSL team was the first team in the modern era, you know, DP era, that had like a really concrete game-to-game tactical identity that was sophisticated. And it came from that diamond. But if you look at the way the diamond played, like most, Taquito wants part of this. Like most diamonds actually play as like a 4-3-1-2, where you just have the number 10 sitting underneath the two forwards and, you know, being the genius. And RSL could do that, but with the way their diamond played, it was actually more of like a rotation based system, because Javi would always love to drift out left. And when he drifted, then the shuttler would push up on the right, and suddenly Beckerman is flaring out to the right, and the left side shuttler, whether it was Andy Williams or usually Will Johnson, he would actually drop deeper and suddenly become a defensive midfielder. And then Wingert would push up on the left and become not an overlapping fullback, but more of like another almost like wide defensive midfield, like a possession fulcrum. And that would give them the string of good passers in the deep line that could be like the possession focal point, right? And they would like sort of stretch you out. And once you would get stretched out, then Javi's finding those pockets, or Fabian Espindola is finding those pockets, or they're playing directly off of Alvaro Saborío, who is a really good hold-up forward. And they would change the way they attacked one after another after another. And it was all about rhythm. It was the first team in MLS that I've seen really since those great DC United teams early, which we'll be talking about in the next show. Like, it was the first team that I've seen in MLS really play like that. And they were really focused on doing that and imposing that upon you and beating you with the ball. This RSL team is the first team in modern MLS history that said it's not going to be about, you know, not to say they couldn't battle in midfield, not to say that they couldn't occasionally beat you with speed and they were great on set pieces, but they were like, we're going to use the ball to rip you apart and destroy you. And they were great at it. And they should have won CONCACAF Champions League. And it breaks my heart that they didn't. And I just really hope, and it's our job to make sure that a team that was this good, that got so close so often, it's our job to make sure that they are not forgotten. And it's entirely appropriate that they're in the last eight of this bracket.
And on top of everything Doyle said, to in CCL play at a time when it was like, can MLS teams get results against Mexican teams in tough environments? They lost in the group stage to Cruz Azul 5-4 down in Mexico, but like went toe-to-toe with one of the giants of Mexico, beat them in at home, got the results at Saprissa, which was kind of, I mean, the national team's never even done that. And then tied 2-2 at Monterrey. And this was, you know, a buzzsaw of a Monterrey team that won every CCL for 3 years and dominated teams consistently in Mexico. So what they did from a perception point of view, you know, in continental competition has, I think, springboarded a lot of like the belief in MLS teams over the last eight, 9 years that they could do this. And we've seen it repeated, you know, over the time, I think, obviously, the last few years, and we'll talk about Toronto here. But I think from a perception point of view, on top of everything Doyle said, to say like we can compete toe to toe and everything they did, it was like you don't have to be New York and LA. And it's not just bringing in Beckham that allows you to compete. You don't have to go get Torsten Frings and things like that. You can compete across Major League Soccer. Then we saw RSL, then we saw KC do it. And I think we're the way Red Bulls have chose to build their team, a lot of that all comes from what was built in 2008 and 2009.
Well, yeah, I think the word belief was what I was really going to say, and I'm glad that you said it, because I don't remember people thinking about CCL and teams thinking about CCL in the same way until we saw RSL do that. And then it was like this crazy perfect storm too, because now are people like, hey, MLS for Toronto FC, MLS for the Montreal Impact? Like, hell no. That's just not the way it works, because everybody wants it and everybody's focused on it. But at that time, I remember it being like intoxicating, MLS for RSL and the game nights and everybody being on that side and seeing Scotty Riddell. There's a throwback for those of you that know content in this league, doing his inside like documentary style series that was ahead of its time. I mean, everybody felt invested. And then to go to the building part too, I think they have a legacy, not just in the way that they were built, but in sort of Garth Lagerwey, the executive, and then Craig Weibel, the executive, and then, you know, now Elliot there in RSL. Like, there's sort of a buildup on how to do it and how to approach it as a quote-unquote smaller market that maybe didn't exist before and didn't exist certainly because the roster rules were different and coming into their own. I think people took what they did and ran with it and tried to replicate it, whether it's a player like Javi Moe, who wasn't, you know, a huge name in Argentina, but was a very productive player in MLS, or a Fabian Espindola, finding these sort of like on the fringe guys in Argentina that can be difference makers in MLS. Like, their legacy is huge.
But at the same time, Weeby, it's getting players who have played in that environment before. So when you're playing those CCL matches, it's not, you come down there and you're like, whoa, I can't handle this. You're talking about Espindola, Olave, Saborío, Javi Moe. These guys have come from these countries and those environments and that type of, you know, when you see those fans go playing in some of those crazy stadiums, you're not like ice, you're not like suffocated. You're like, I know this. I'm ready for this. I can play in this environment and have success. So I think that also was a blueprint for these MLS teams to have guys coming from those, you know, Central American countries, South America, where now they can play in CCL and it's not, oh man, this is Mount Everest. We can't beat a team like Monterrey. We can't beat a team like Cruz Azul. So Big congratulations to Salt Lake for making it this far. Now,
bon voyage. Wait, Charlie, sidebar here. Have you played at the Purple Monster? Charlie, have you played at Saprissa?
Yes.
With the national team?
Yes.
How bad is it? Is it equal to Azteca? What's that experience?
Nothing touches Azteca.
Well, but we've gotten worse results there.
I know. It was turf. It was like right on top. They're right on top of you. You feel the animosity. You know you're in a – it's a very tough place to play. They thrive there as well. I believe we lost 2-1 maybe when I was playing there. It was World Cup qualifier. But I think that they're not as – it's not as fearful anymore. I think when you think of Costa Rica, they're a solid team. But right now, where we are as a country, when you go down into Costa Rica, like you should be looking to get a result now. It's not like it was once back in the day.
Yeah. I think that's the same in some ways with CCL too. The record against Costa Rican teams has gotten to a point where MLS teams sort of expect to win. That's not always universal. We've seen a lot of upsets. Any final touches on RSL 2010? The whole shebang. I mean, I think your point about additional trophies is an important one, Doyle, because I think they may fall in the same sort of zone as like a, I don't know, we've been talking a lot about these early fire teams that mm-hmm. were very good, either at the very top or right there in the upper echelon with the very best, but just didn't have, and the fire teams had more trophies, didn't fire have enough.
The fire teams had like five,
and,
six
and if the trophies. Fire teams didn't have enough, given the players that they had, it's tough for RSL to be in that same sort of conversation. I mean, they were on the brink of a dynasty if they could have just got the job done in those big matches.
It's more like the Revs, right? It's more like the 2000s Revs who finished second in four separate MLS Cups, finished runners-up in four separate MLS Cups. I think they were runners-up in the Shield twice, and they just got that one U.S. Open Cup. So they did get a trophy. With this RSL team, they were runners up in the Shield twice. They were runners up in MLS Cup once. They were runners up in US Open Cup once, and they were runner up in CCL once. They did get that one MLS Cup though. They're remembered for 2009, but I remember that not because it was such a great performance in MLS Cup or because that was such a great team, but because it launched this beautiful era for RSL, where again it was they were the first team in the modern era who was like, we're going to beat you with the ball. We're going to do that. The other thing to remember them for was their marketing effort. The team is the star, which was great. But it was also a lie because Javi Morales was the star. Javier Morales, he came in 2007. He was not a DP, but he was as effective a player as any of the DPs who were imported in that class. And one of the things he did, well, first of all, he came at 26 or 27. So he was the first of this new wave of South American DPs or South American playmakers, rather, to come in his prime, which was huge. And second, he's buddies with like Diego Valeri. He's buddies with a lot of these guys who came later. He was integral in opening up that pathway to Latin America, specifically really to Argentina, for the next generation of MLS, and he is without question one of the most important signings and one of the best signings in MLS history. So this team should be remembered and celebrated and in a lot of ways emulated even today.
We're not going to talk. Go ahead.
I said, Javi Mo was class. He was class.
Yeah.
He's class. And also he lost, you know, time to injury. I mean, he's one of those guys in that era where you're like, man, had he not gotten this sort of catastrophic injury, you put David Ferreira in that category as well, you put mm-hmm. Steve Zakuani there, there were some real talents lost in that era, and he came back and his recovery was also part of the inspiration too for this RSL team.
Yeah, because Javi Mo couldn't run anyway, so he lost he lost his speed, but he didn't have speed to begin with. So.
Sorry RSL fan vote, our votes, Toronto FC is on, they are into the final four. They will take on the winner of our next matchup here, 2014 LA, 2014 Seattle. We already have a win in this category, and producer Anders will be very excited to know that the 2014 Seattle Sounders away kit was the winner of MLSsoccer.com's best best jersey of all time. And now you know why we didn't give fans the 100% on our greatest team of all time, because we're trying to have somebody other than Seattle or Atlanta win this thing, folks. It's all about the right results, not the most popular results. These two teams met in the playoffs.
Spicy.
I'm just saying, I was frustrated by that. That's clearly not the best jersey in MLS history, but what are you going to do? Fan vote, late rally.
So this is the weirdest one because they're the same year. So they are they actually played on the field. We don't really have to fake it. They played five times that year. They went 2-2-1 just to make this a little bit harder. So they split that perfectly. Seattle wins Supporters Shield just over the Galaxy. And then the Galaxy knocks Seattle out of the playoffs in the Western Conference Finals. So this partially comes down to Supporters Shield truther in this. And then partially comes down to like what you want to judge. They played three times in the regular season. Chad Marshall missed one game. Seattle lost. Omar Gonzalez missed one game. The Galaxy lost. Then they played twice in the playoffs. Ozzy missed the first leg. The Galaxy won. Then the Galaxy lost the second leg and went through on away goal. So they literally split as hard as you can across this matchup head-to-head to make this almost impossible. And then you guys, we can all pick our random reasoning for how we're going to get through this.
So Sounders at heart, which everybody knows if you're listening to this show, I assume, do a great job covering the Sounders out there in Seattle, SB Nation. They had a late push here, and I think that's what got the Sounders over the line on the fan vote, because before that, the Galaxy had the percentage, but Seattle gets one vote here from the fans, 53% to 47. So there's one for Seattle. Charlie, if you had to, since this is your year, of course, you were an MLS Cup finalist, you played the Galaxy. If you had to make a decision here, which team was better? Which team would get your vote and why?
Both teams were phenomenal. And if I had to choose one, it's going to be the champions. It's LA Galaxy. Seattle were too dependent on Obafemi Martins and Clint Dempsey in the attacking half. They really were. It was great to watch the two work. But LA Galaxy could hurt you in different ways. Jossie Zardes just came onto the scene. I think he had 16 goals that season. Then you realize, okay, this guy can score goals for you. Robbie Keane's MVP year. Landon Donovan, like Doyle always says, he gets cut from the U.S. men's national team, comes back to MLS, and just sets it on fire. He was unbelievable in that second leg too in the playoff series, where he juked somebody out to cross it over to Ishizaki, who I think Stefan Fry makes an incredible save on a header in the 6-yard box. But Landon was just devoted to proving everybody that he should have been on that 2014 World Cup squad. He was out for blood. And he played extremely well. The Galaxy team just was a complete team. Sarvas was also a huge influence in the midfield with Juninho. They had a good partnership. You had Robbie Rogers on the left flank, who was great at making overlapping runs, could also score goals. We've seen him terrorize defenses when he was playing more of as an attacking player with Columbus Crew. So they've shown that they're a little bit more dynamic, this LA Galaxy team. And when it comes down to it, they won MLS Cup. It's not that they just beat Seattle in the playoffs and then lost eventually to us in the final. No, it was they beat Seattle and then they finished the job. It's got to be the champions. It's got to be LA Galaxy. But this Seattle Sounders team was legit. From Chad Marshall, Stefan Fry, you had Alonso in the midfield, and then Oba Deuce in the up top. I mean, it's a strong, strong spine. But I think when you look at the other players involved, I think Galaxy gets the nod.
And that's the other players thing, right? Because if you look at this Galaxy team, the third best attacker on this team was either Ishizaki, who was Swedish international winger, or Jossie Zardes, who's going to end up with 100 MLS goals. He scored double-digit goals, I think, four times in his career now. This was his first year doing it. Who was the third best attacker on this Sounders team? After Open Juice.
Maybe with Marco Nagel? Papa?
Mexican legend, Gonzalo Pineda.
I knew you were going
to say. He's not an attacker.
Brad Evans. Evans, who we put on our Mount Rushmore. DeAndre Yedlin.
He didn't go on Mount Rushmore.
Did you not hear
Brad Evans didn't go on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, Brad Evans is not on Mount Rushmore. And did you hear me say the word attacker?
You're stretching now. You're going all over the place.
Brad Evans started at right midfield for them on the wing.
He's a defensive player. He's a defensive player. And he's a utility guy. You put him all over
the place. Charlie, you started Jermaine Jones at the 10. Get out of my face.
Who started Jermaine?
Lee Wynn started at the 10. He's
digging. Help pass out. He's lost.
I'm trying. So I think just the top end quality from like your top three or four attackers was higher overall for LA. And then the other thing is like in the big moments, Robbie Keane showed up. In the big moments, Landon Donovan showed up. In the big moments, Clint Dempsey showed up. In the big moments in MLS, Obafemi Martins did not show up. He just didn't. He has 10 games worth, I think, of playoff appearances, 0 goals, 0 assists. And this bracket isn't who would win over a 35-game season. It's who would win in a knockout game. And in a knockout game, we literally saw it. The 2014 LA Galaxy team beats this 2014 Seattle Sounders team. And the other thing, just shout out to the analytics community. This was the first team that they fell in love with. If you go to certain depths of the analytics community, they will tell you that what the Galaxy did from May when Landon came back to the end of the year in terms of just overall dominance, the underlying numbers just jump off the page, as does that goal differential, plus 32 goal differential. There are only like 3 or 4 teams in MLS history that are plus 30 or better over the entire season.
Just as my contractual requirement to push back on Doyle throwing any shade at Obafemi Martins. Obviously, won Open Cup for them in 2014. Also, the last two games of the regular season of this year was at LA and then LA at home between these two teams, sitting on equal points for Supporter Shield. Oba had 2 assists in LA to bring them back from 2-0 down, and then had an assist in the home game, which won them the Supporter Shield.
He did win them the shield because he was like, once they went down at LA in the second to last week of the season, it was like, oh, it felt like destiny. It felt like, oh, this is Landon's last year. Of course, LA is going to win everything. And Obo was just insane the rest of that game and the next game. So he was great in the regular season. He was incredible.
There's also a legacy factor too. I know you're talking about, hey, what they do, what they win. But if you look at the rest of this bracket, I mean, this is the LA Galaxy team that is left. And if you're measuring them against Seattle, who didn't have the history of winning championships, who didn't win the championship, it's hard to put them over it. Also, when you watch this thing back, it was a bizarre playoff series too. It wasn't just that they were even. It was that there were like fluky, weird goals that were scored. I mean, the winner for LA in the first one is a crazy deflection. You know, Stefan Fry had to stand on his head in this game, but it's like a huge deflection off of Marcelo Sarvis' cross. Clint Dempsey's second goal to bring Seattle back in trickles through Jaime Pinedo. It's another weird, like, semi-deflection one. And then Juninho wins it on the away goal with the drive from deep. So, like, it's hard to put them head-to-head.
But to go back to, like, what makes them good in those big moments, in the Galaxy home game where they went up 2-0, they're both set-piece goals where the ball knocks around, and one's a deflected long shot as well. So, like, there was not much difference between these teams outside of star players missing games, and the Galaxy cut Seattle open in the first game, but Chad Marshall didn't play and they were up 2-0 in 16 minutes for the Galaxy on the road, which is impressive. But it's razor thin, both on the field in real life, and then I think in this vote. You talk about championships, though. Seattle won a double. And they were this close away from going to an MLS Cup at a time when we'd never seen a domestic treble in MLS history. And I understand, for Charlie's point of view, like, winning championships is everything. And he went to that MLS Cup and lost. But, like, the Galaxy only played 2 games in Open Cup and they got railhawked and didn't have to do any of that work. Seattle had to fly across the country, play an extra time final, win that game. By the way, those count as trophies. And then come back and win Supporter Shield.
I would never have
at a record level in terms of most wins ever in MLS history.
I would never.
Pushing a points number.
I would never, ever have anyone else play the devil's advocate over you. That was phenomenal.
No, I mean, it is a great point, though, David. And it's why this Galaxy team, as great as they were in the second half of the season in the playoffs, it's why they're frankly probably not going to win this bracket.
Yeah.
It's because they just completely tapped out of of one of the tournaments but that they were in.
Isn't that the most Bruce thing of all time, where he's like, I don't even give a bleep about your stupid bracket. Go. Like, who cares about your bracket? We won MLS Cup. Yeah. That's the whole point, is he chose what he wanted to win.
I mean, you know, to be fair, we'd rather be talking about week 12 of the MLS season.
For sure. Yeah, if we had a choice. But that is like sort of the demerit on the LA team, is that Bruce prioritized and he decided, hey, this is what I want. Now, you can't take anything away from Seattle. They handled the business. But like, if Bruce the whole year is saying what matters to us is the supporter shield, do we really think that they don't find a way to get it done or have a place at the back end? If he cared about the Open Cup ever, do you think they might have won one? Like, they had the guys to do it. He just didn't care.
I don't know that you can give credence there, because then you're talking about, I don't know, could David Beckham at 35 push an Open Cup and then still perform in Major League Soccer? Could Robbie Keane? Like, I don't think you can give any argument there. Hence why I think this thing is going to end up coming down to TFC actually sealed the door on all the things they did. They don't give us space to question them. All these teams give us space to question them at this elite level because they took their foot off the gas in places.
I think that's a fair point.
Gas, man.
All right. They're through. That's what we're saying, right? We're saying that the Galaxy are through, correct?
I'm voting Seattle.
Okay, that's two for Seattle. So it has to be a sweep for the Galaxy for the rest of us. Dave puts the pressure on. I'm Galaxy.
We know where Charlie stands. I'm because Galaxy. Charlie is, I played them in the final, so they must be the best team.
We lost to the best team.
that's definitely the Kansas Jayhawks attitude there. I appreciate that. Doyle, who you got? Make this decision.
Oh man, this is tough. Not because it's tough to choose between these two teams, because it's obvious. I think that one team is just a little bit better than the other, but just to be like a contrarian troll, like
you have that opportunity. You can feel it.
And like those Sounders fans, they give me a lot of page views. I could earn some goodwill right here by putting the Sounders through, but like Obafemi Martins, I'm not going to finish the job.
Wow. No respect.
Wow. Well done. You were setting that thing up, like building blocks, just raising it up, just to knock it all down. Galaxy.
Yeah.
You're through.
Come on, man.
Goss was feeling good. He was feeling good about that.
No, I wouldn't. Even if I had won that on that Doyle vote, I would have gone and taken a shower after the show. I would have felt disgusting with that win.
Your weekly shower.
Is there a bigger legacy point for the Sounders in this one? Because up until this point, this had probably been their best playoff run, really. In 2015, they wouldn't get the job done. Obviously, that would be the Timbers. But then it would be their time after that. Is there a legacy here that this team pushes on for future Sounders championship teams? Or was this sort of its own standalone great team?
I personally think it's an example of their ability to create more than one great team. I look at them as different eras, even though Chad Marshall and Stephen Fry carry over. When you look at the face of 2014 and then you look at 2016 and 2019, in my mind, they're different groups, they're different teams, and it's to their credit as a franchise that they didn't just build one good team. And I'm not trying to knock RSL at all, but RSL is, you know, this one group, pieces moved in and out, but it's 2009 to 2013, the same group. For Seattle, it's the expansion team that was good early on and won Open Cups with Freddie Montero and that group. It is the 2014 group, the Oba Deuce group, and then you've got MLS Cup teams, a team that went to 3 of 4 years and won 2 of them.
But isn't there I'm thinking this through in my head, but there is still, just like RSL, when you had sort of that central vein, you still have that. I mean, Stephen Fry's a late arrival, but he is, with these two teams, he is that guy in goal who stands, Chad Marshall, throughout except for the last championship. Brad
Evans.
It's
only 2 year difference.
Ozzie Alonso.
But the first thing you say about 2014 Seattle is Oba Deuce.
Yeah.
Right. The two most important players were not on the field in 2016 when they won MLS Cup. So to have the depth and the ability to adjust your franchise to continue to operate at a high level without your two best players 2 years later, I think shows it's different than what we saw. And you could say with the Galaxy, if you want, from 2011 to 14, to lose Beckham and shift and probably be better than in 14 is impressive. But I think it just, for Seattle, it shows a better franchise over the course of their time in MLS.
Well, it just shows that Garth Lagerwey has a good idea of when to bring in new talent, when to move talent, how to build what they already have. they've done a fantastic job and one of the best to ever do it, especially when you look at from Freddie Montero, Seattle Sounders days to now. It's super impressive. And to just continue to promote talent. Like you look at Jordan Morris, but you also look before that at DeAndre Yedlin. So, I mean, Seattle
but
Sounders
we do have to say,
are doing
given
it,
credit,
doing it well.
Garth didn't get there until 2015. Yeah. So he doesn't get credit. I think Chris Henderson and Adrian Hanauer and Ziggy Schmidt get a lot of credit for those early years building 2014. But I would agree with you, Charlie. And what he, I think, does better than everyone is while he has a long-term plan, he's able to make really short-term, good short-term moves, like even bringing in an Ivanchitz, who isn't a difference maker, but gives you enough talent to get you over the edge in big games, in big moments, while still having a long-term plan that he doesn't ruin. I don't know if this is the right thing to say, but what Bruce did in L.A., he left at the perfect time because he made a lot of short-term moves and it all came crashing down at the same time on Kurt Anolfo's head. But that was always going to happen because of the way they worked to just win now, win now, win now.
Right.
If you look at what happened to LA, you could make a really good argument that Steven Gerrard is the worst DP signing of all time. Well, that's for another show.
I mean, there are some other classified as DP that are definitely worse.
I mean, they were worse players, but in terms of destroying a franchise, Gerrard was supposed to pick up the baton from Keane and Beckham, and he just wanted nothing to do with it. And the Galaxy, relative to expectation, expenditure, and previous accomplishments, what has happened to the Galaxy in the TAM era is, it's unreal that this team is so mediocre.
Then I would throw it on Giovanni Dos Santos. Because
he deserves it too.
He was supposed to be the Carlos Vela. Yep. Now, you know, be that guy who's going to take the franchise to another level or continue to be at the level that those Galaxy teams were in 2011, 12, 14.
Yeah. Not happening.
I do appreciate where we've gotten to, though.
Yeah. We went from here and excellence to Gerrard and Gio.
Hey, this is extra time.
Yeah, exactly.
Very important.
Yeah.
I think I just want to build on really quick what David said. I do think that the takeaway with this Sounders team is this specific Sounders team, it has to be taken in the context of, as David said, what this franchise did from 2009 to 2020, staying more than just competitive, but winning titles regularly, whether it's Open Cup, Supporter Shield, U.S. Open Cup. And I think every Sounders fan looks at this particular team justifiably as what might have been the one that got away just because they couldn't quite get over the hump against the Galaxy. And I'm sure that causes them a lot of pain. And I'm still talking about it because I know it's driving Anders berserk right now.
Yeah, you can see.
But they have a couple of MLS Cups to rest on, so I think they're okay.
It's not too bad now, but Anders still says, quote, still sad. So you've done your job there. Next Thursday, the other side, Discovery Rights Region and CCL Region, the teams remaining to potentially face off against either 2017 Toronto or 2014 LA. I think Toronto is almost certainly going to be in that final. Our 2019 LAFC, 98 DC United, 97 DC, and 2018 Atlanta United. So we'll put the poll out on Wednesday. Make sure you vote.
I think we can already put everyone in the final because Doyle just votes based off MLS Cups. So he can't pick teams that have won Supporters Shield because he doesn't care about it. Right. That's shown by his track record over the course of the last month.
It's not regular season.
But actually, the one cup he values over Supporters Shield is the Inter-American Cup. So I think that...
Sure. Played at Lockhart Stadium.
Yeah, that DC team's got a real chance there because they've got the crown jewel in their hat. So
I'm 100% voting for that DC United team from 1998. So, 100%.
Actually, when you vote,
I'm actually
there,
surprised Doyle
that.
Didn't just push... I'm surprised Doyle didn't just put all the Interliga and Superliga winning teams straight into the bracket and put them in the final. See, the Revs have won two cups.
I'm shocked we didn't mention Superliga for the Revs. That's their other big trophy. Huge at the time.
Huge.
Massive. Massive. First thing you see when you walk in the training ground.
I saw a lot of celebrations on the bench because we all knew what that meant.
Bonus!
Charlie can attest, Manch Vegas had a parade. It was huge. All of New England celebrated.
Yes. Absolutely.
All right, let's talk real quick here as we're sort of like breaking down the differences between 2014 Galaxy and Seattle. This is playoff week at MLSsoccer.com. We are, you know how it goes by now. It's jerseys, it's themes, it's history. It's trying to keep us all engaged as we wait for the soccer to return. Here's the big question for you, and I'll start this one with you, Charlie. What makes a good playoff team? Because so much of our discussions in this greatest team of all time ultimately come down to, as you said, who gets the job done? So in your mind, having done it, having watched it, now analyzing it, what makes a good playoff team? What are the critical ingredients?
Well, when you talk about those early years, especially those LA Galaxy dominant years, 2011, 12, 14, it was all about momentum, right? Heading into the postseason hot, getting everybody bought in. You take the early couple months of the season to kind of get into a rhythm, flow, take it easy. And then as soon as that summer, midsummer comes, you come together and you start racking up the wins. You head into September, everybody is like, this team is hot. This is the team to beat. And you carry that confidence with you into the playoffs. And that usually meant you were going to get to the final or win it, because you guys were just in a rhythm. Everybody was in sync. And that typically meant results. Also sprinkled in there is experience. Having guys who have done it before with previous teams, having that leadership on the field as well as in the locker room to have that balance. It's all about having the right balance of knowing when to push guys, knowing when to joke around and take some of the heat off some of the guys, having a coach who's been in that situation who can do the same thing, making those tough decisions come playoff time. Oh, this is when we're going to play a certain player who maybe hasn't played that much. I'm going to start him today. And then maybe in the second leg, I'm going to play a reserve or inject a reserve into the game much sooner or earlier than I'm used to. So having the right coach to push the buttons at the right time too, that's what makes a playoff team special. But as we've seen over the past couple of seasons, you're now having clubs want to win everything. It's not just MLS Cup. We want Supporter Shield. We want CCL. We want success in every competition we play in. And that's kind of, I think, speaks greatly of how this league has evolved, because you want championships as a team. You strive for everything. It's not just MLS Cup. It's Supporter Shield and MLS Cup. It's Campeones Cup. It's CCL. Anything we play in, we want to win. And I love that. That's how it should be played. Every time you step on the field, we want to win.
Everyone was blown away by that.
Yeah, right?
Not the knowledge.
I'm just
Charlie 2020.
No, I'm.
I'll just say this to what Charlie said. I agree with what he said, but I think a lot of times the way I think about experience is there are teams that won't beat themselves, and we've talked about that a little bit in these brackets. Even though they didn't get over the line of time, those old Revs teams, especially the Houston Dynamo teams that won MLS Cups. They weren't going to give it away at any point. They were going to hang in the game at all times. And then you had playmakers. And to experience, you look at a lot of the teams that have won in MLS, 2013 KC, 2017 Toronto FC, they've lost right before. And they've seen a little bit of a difference. And I think when you look at those two teams, they're two teams in that KC team and Toronto team that had like an identity and a style that they wanted to play, lost, and then came back with a little bit more of that veteran, we can adapt to games when we have to. I think 2017 Toronto is the best example of the way they lost to Seattle in 2016. And then to turn around, they got Victor Vasquez. But at times in 2017, they adapted the way they played. They sat back, they hit on the counter. And I think when you look at 2015, the examples that were set for Porter to go away from the way he wanted to play, and for Greg Berhalter, who probably believes in the way he wants to play as much as anyone in MLS, to change what he did against the Red Bulls, was that idea of you either have to have an A-plus identity and be able to dominate the game, or you have to be able to adapt and not beat yourself and hang in tough away games and get that, you know, gritty result. And so I think you see the two extremes of it. And we've seen some really good teams combined it all. I think Seattle's the best example of at times it's flowing and at times it's whatever we have to do just to get through, aka winning an MLS Cup without having a shot on goal. But you're starting to see MLS teams, I think, look at past groups and learn how to build and adapt to be good in the playoffs.
I think the building part is probably the most important, right? I mean, like, we can talk about momentum, we can talk about experience, all these things, but ultimately it comes down to one, talent, and then two, when I think of what you said, Dave, about like not making a mistake, it's teams that are able to build the back half of their roster with that experience or with those guys that aren't going to make those mistakes. You can go all the way back to like, I mean, really any team that's done it, but I'm going to go all the way back to like 6-7 Houston Dynamo, where, you know, some of the guys they had weren't the most talented players in the world, but who on the back line was going to F up? Who was going to mess up in that big moment? Nobody. And then you had the top end talent because you had D-Row and at the time Ching and Stu Holden and Jeff Cameron. Like, it's that mixture both in building, but then in managing your team to keep guys engaged throughout the season, even if they're not playing a ton because they may have to be there, and to have the right guys on the back end of the roster, because so much in MLS all the way up until now, like, you can sign the best players. You can have Joseph Martinez. You can have Diego Valera. You can have like the top players in the league. But if you're 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, can't hack it against the other teams, it's just not going to happen for you. And so it's such a, you know, we hear in the Last Dance about organization. I think in MLS, it comes down to a lot that too, because one, you're playing under strict rules that the rest of the world is not having to play under when you sign players. And two, the nature of the competition and the travel and the team building and the coaching and the level of player from 1 to 20 can be pretty disparate. So you have to hit on every note. And I think most of the MLS Cup champions have done that. And that's what makes some teams like I'm even going to say 2009 RSL, like special and an outlier, because that team maybe didn't have all that. They had the beginnings of that, but they were able to get through. But I think most teams had most, if not all, if you look back at the last 15 years of MLS. There's not a lot of teams as far as champions where like doesn't deserve to be there. They hit on just about everything they needed to hit on.
Mm-hmm. I think that 2009 RSL team, like, they lost Javier Morales 20 minutes into MLS Cup, but they still had Ned Grabovoy to play. And Ned Grabovoy, not an all-star caliber MLS player, but he was certainly a type of player you could throw out there and get the job done. And so, yeah, they absolutely did have that. The thing that, you know, Charlie said experience, and I agree. And the play that keeps popping into my mind is the second Seattle goal from the playoff game against LAFC this past year. Experience manifests itself, shows itself on the field in your ability to do risk assessments and make the right play, even if it's the ugly play, in crunch moments. And in that moment at midfield, Seattle has just won the ball and pushed it out to the right flank. And Atuesta is side by side with Raul Ruiz Diaz, and he's behind the play now. Atuesta did not wipe Ruiz Diaz out. If that was Gustav Svensson and Adama Diomande, Gustav Svensson would have buried Adama Diomande behind the play, because the last thing you want is him coming down the middle, getting on the ball at zone 14 and firing home from 22 yards. And that is exactly what happened on that play. Now, if LAFC get into a big time game, whether it's CCL or MLS or, you know, Campeon, whatever the hell, you know, they're playing in, and Atuesta has a chance to make that play again, I think he makes the veteran Kyle Beckerman, Diego Chara, Ozzy Alonso, Gustav Svensson type of defensive midfielder play right there, which is, you know, the ref's not looking at you. You know, this is, even though it's low probability, it's still a probability of a shot on goal or even a goal. You wipe the man out behind the play right now, because you cannot put your team in a situation where you're suddenly down 2-1 in an elimination game and everybody now is clenching.
And I think I agree with what Doyle said, but another example is NYCFC versus Toronto FC. Still no one can explain what Matarita did. Hadn't really been in that situation before. The Toronto guys had been there before. There was zero chance they were going to win that game. NYCFC had a style they were going to impose themselves. It turns out it's a cold night on a baseball field. It doesn't work out perfectly. Toronto adjusted and got through, and NYCFC weren't able to find a way. And what's interesting about them is, I talked about Toronto and SKC losing and coming back. They keep cycling out coaches, so it'll be interesting to see for this year and for the future. Like, is it the group that builds on itself, or does it have to be the same coach in that environment? But it's another example of just one group had been there, and they knew the 50.1% they had to do to get over the edge. And the other team was trying to win 80-20 and just wasn't able to get it done on a tough one game knockout.
Yeah. And credit, by the way, credit to Ronald Monterita for standing up and being a man after that one, because it was a brutal play. It was a brainless and unnecessary play, and he could have hid. He could have done anything, but what he did, which was apologize to his teammates and to the fans, and I think they actually appreciate him more because of that. And it makes him easy to root for.
And maybe that's the moment for NYC, like you were talking about, Dave, where that's sort of the institutional knowledge that they need as a club, a franchise, a squad, an individual player, whatever it is, that when that comes back to get over the hump. We have a little piece from Greg Seltzer on MLSsoccer.com coming up this week. Clutch players, Mr. October or November. I went and looked at game-winning goals and assists. Ooh, Dairon, he's not up at the top, but this is his honorary award, of course. Landon Donovan has 10 more five more game-winning goals than anybody else in MLS playoff history. 10-5 over Jaime Moreno. BWP right behind him with 5 game-winning goals, too. That's pretty incredible. Landon, of course, also right up near the top with game-winning assists. Let us know your favorite playoff memories, your favorite playoff players, whatever it may be, at Extra Time, extratime at MLSsoccer.com. Let's keep it rolling, though, Doyle. I saw your piece. Little column going up, the top MLS prospects right now. Give us 3. They don't have to be the top 3 with the current comp that you're really just like, I can't wait for soccer to be back to watch these guys develop.
Boy, there's okay. I forgot who I listed. Well, I mean, let's start with Ricardo Pepi, right? We should start with FC Dallas. He's the 17-year-old center forward. He played for the USU-17 national team. He, I think, scored 11 goals in 13 games last year for Dallas's USL championship side.
USL North One, Texas.
Yeah, USL One. Thank you. And they won the title, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he was, I mean, he's big-bodied. He has really good balance. His link-up play isn't incredible. So the comparison I made is to Mauro Manotas, who when he came here, you could see he had all the tools, but like still needed some polishing. That's where Ricardo Pepi is, but as a 17-year-old. So it's nice to see that. He got on the field already this year. He scored himself a very nice equalizing goal. Who was that against? That was against Montreal.
It doesn't even matter, Doyle. Dude, it was 17 years ago.
Oh my God, I can't even. That feels like it never happened. Like you say that, and I'm thinking back, and I'm like, dear God, there were games played 2.5 months ago.
Yeah. So he's a super high level prospect. I think if you look at this most recent USU-17 national team, Gio Reyna, obviously the highest level prospect, but Ricardo Pepi, not very far behind him on that level.
Charlie, can I?
And Doyle, I think you could say of the last 5 years, from a U.S. youth point of view, outside of Josh Sargent, he's the best forward prospect we've had since a while.
I think other than Sargent, he's the best prospect that we've had come through the U.S. youth national team pipeline as a center forward since Josie. So it goes from Josie to Sargent to Pepi. Pepi might be a little bit more of an instinctive goal scorer than Sargent is, but he doesn't, like, Sargent is so smooth and so good on the turn. I think Sargent's slightly higher level. Who else did I
before
have?
Before you keep going, like, rack your brain, Charlie, when you're watching young forwards, what are you looking for? Like, to think high level, maybe U.S. national team, great professional. What do they have to have?
There's a number of things. The first thing I look at is their influence on the game when they're not involved in the buildup. How are their runs? Where are they making their runs? Are they taking defenders with them? If they're not getting the ball to their feet, how can they still make a difference? Can they beat players on the dribble? That's one thing I love to see. If a striker can get in behind, and when you do make a run in behind, you're in the final third, where coaches usually say, you can do what you want. In the final third, you can take those touches. You can take chances. You can take risks. Because if we do lose the ball in the final third, it's okay. It's in the middle third of the field or in the defensive half where you check into and receive a ball to relieve pressure from your back line, and you lose the ball there trying a trick or two. That's when you get in trouble. But in the final third, you get the ball. You're faced up 1v1 with a defender. What are you going to do? Are you going to just play the safe ball? or are you going to take chances? You're going to take risks. And once you do get by that defender, is your head up? Who are you looking to find? That's what I love to look at in the striker is, can we get the ball to you? And can you break down a defense, or can you be that guy to pull a defender out of position to hopefully involve one of your other teammates and get them the ball so they can capitalize in the moment? So I'm always interested to see movement off the ball. And when they do have the ball, will they take chances? Will they take risks of beating a defender 1v1?
How do you spot a professional level finisher? Is it as simple as Ricardo Pepi scores goals in League One as a 17-year-old? How do you pick that out? How do you know?
It's just before they're about to shoot, or just before they have that inch of space to pull the trigger. Do they have that patience? That patience not to rush. Are they rushing their chances, or is it calm, cool, collected right before they finish? That's the difference right there. Is it a rush shot? Is it a sliding kick? Is it kind of like a panic mode? They still get the goal, or is it everything's fast, but right before the shot, do they slow themselves down, compose themselves, and then pick their corner and finish? That's the true mark of a goal scorer, is that final last second before you actually shoot. Are you in a place of calm being? Are you composed, or are you rushing?
Charlie, I would say, I don't know how you feel, but like what you're saying is the mentality of how they handle that moment, because, you know, pure technique, that's actually one of those things you can work on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what you're saying is the stuff that's natural at 17 to then say, okay, he doesn't wrap his foot around the ball perfectly in the next moment. I can continue to improve that as a coach, you know, working with him. But the thing that's natural to them is that panic, how they handle the biggest moment of the game, because we talk about 80, 90% of this, but if you don't finish, you don't win. And I see the same with young guys, where it's like some guys score goals, but it's easy, or it's awkward, or it's uncomfortable, and they look panicked. And other guys, they look calm. It's not always placed away. But you're like, at 16, 17, if that's where they're at mentally, you can improve the way they do it over the next 4 or 5 years.
100%. And I always love the things that when a 16 or 17-year-old pulls off something that I didn't see, or I didn't expect them to see. So they're in a box, the defender's coming hard, you can shoot it, but maybe they chop it to the right because they know there's so much space that they can actually take the time to have a calm finish rather than trying to rush it near post or far post to try and beat that sliding defender. If you have that time, a lot of people, they see the goal and it's like, oh my God, I got to shoot because it's now or never. But for a 16 or 17-year-old kid to say, you know what, I can fake shoot it here, chop it. And it's not that I'm not trying to rush or take too much time. I know that I'll have enough time to take a second, compose myself, and finish far post.
I mean, that's that, like,
that's special.
What we were talking about with, like, risk assessment live, that's sort of like the instinctual ability to have that snapshot of the field and what's happening and say, I know where a better percentage is and I can get myself there. Like, it's two different things, knowing yes. And then having the ability to do so. That was interesting.
Right.
Doyle, you got another name for us?
Yeah, so we did one American, so let's do one Canadian as well. I think the consensus best prospect, very young in Canada, is a winger from Toronto FC, Jaquiel Marshall-Ruddy. I've only seen him play a couple of times in age group stuff. People who have seen him more than I have had said he's a Gio Reyna-level prospect. He has the whole bag of tricks, and but doesn't. He's not just doing stepovers for the sake of doing stepovers, but is actually making them functional. David, you're nodding. Have you seen him play a bunch of MLS at GA Cup, rather?
He actually showed up to GA Cup last year and played with both the U-17s and the U-15s. Looks like he's 22.
As a 14-year-old.
And looks like he's 22. Unbelievable body. But like I think, like you said, when I saw Reyna for the first time, it wasn't that he was good. It was that he was different for his age group. He was better than anyone I had seen at that level. And to what Charlie said, he did things differently. He saw things differently. And you could see the gravity of the game around him, the way his team reacts to him and the way the other team does. And I think Russell Rowe, another great winger, like you, TFC actually had a couple. This guy's at a different level, doing things at a different pace. I mean, he signed a pro deal at 14, not just because they think he's good. I mean, they've had Akinyole, they've had Russell Rowe, like they've seen guys. he's at a different level. And I'm pretty excited to watch him play. And you would argue what's great is there's kind of a hole at Toronto FC, and there has been at that spot. It's also a spot where you could give a guy, a young guy like Schaffelberg, got minutes because they can't, they're maybe not going to kill you as often. He's not essential. Like, I'd say Nobel Okolo is one of the best prospects I've seen, but it's really hard to get a 17-year-old at center midfield, a start in Major League Soccer, an appearance, because the position's so important. So I think he's going to have an opportunity to play.
And it's all about mentality. Like you said, you can I can't tell you how many guys when I was 16, 17, even 18, that everyone said, this is the next star. This guy does this, this, and this. But it comes down to mentality, because Eddie Gavin, when we were 16, 17, he could have been playing in the English Premier League. Everyone would have said, this is the greatest talent. He's the guy. It wasn't Freddie Adu, even though what we saw at Freddie Adu when he was 14, everyone in the world wanted him. But it was, as he got older, how does that mentality change? How are you pushing yourself? Are you complacent? And sometimes they get in an environment, whether it's the coach, whether it's the team, everyone's just saying, you're the best, you're great. And they stop pushing. They stop putting themselves in uncomfortable positions. I want those 16, 17, 18-year-olds to continue to push, because you always get to that point where you sign that first big, big contract and everyone's saying, wow, buy me this, buy me that. Can you do this? And you start going to all these appearances and the marketing, and it's great, but you lose sight of what the objective is, and that's to reach your full potential. And the only way you're going to reach your full potential is you keep getting pushed. No matter how many goals you score, no matter how many teams you make, no matter how many national team caps you have, it's continuing to stay at the highest level for as long as you can and striving to be the best. And we don't see too many players that want to hit that mark or continue to push themselves. Because at a point, we've seen over the course of how long, as long as I've played, that guys reach a level and you say, I'm good. I'm not going to continue to struggle or grind or fight to get to that point. I'm good. I've come far enough and I'm good.
Kind of.
So I just wanted to throw in there, I think Charlie and Doyle have obviously seen this longer than me, but one of the pushes in Major League Soccer, and I think Toronto, Philly, New York, and Dallas are probably at the forefront, Atlanta maybe trying to come up there, is the gap of you're a great prospect, you get signed to a pro deal, you're a good pro, like trying to fill in that gap of how to continue to push guys, how to continue to challenge guys, how to make sure that they don't settle when they sign their first pro deal, when they get their first MLS start. That is a big focus for a lot of these MLS clubs. One of it is, I think, is going to be sheer numbers. When you look at Toronto, they're signing 10 homegrowns to USL deals and MLS deals now. They're going to challenge each other because there's not space for everyone. And I think that's going to be big, rather than just Juan Agudelo, you are the future. You're put into the team. There's no one else coming up behind you. You're going to figure it out. I think that's part of it. And then I think the other part of it is just the coaches understanding what's needed for these guys and how to work. And I think we saw maybe Akinyola, plateau a little as he came into the Toronto team. Everything that happens with him is going to be something that staff learns from, that academy learns from, the structure of that team learns from, to then make it better for a guy like Marshall Ruddy.
Well, Akinyola, I can tell you right now, Josie speaks very highly of this kid, but he's behind Josie. When you're looking at the totem pole, how much time are you going to get? If you're a young star who has a ton of potential, you're only going to play or fulfill that potential if you're going to get minutes on the pitch and playing time. When you're playing, when you know, no matter what you do, no matter how well you do it, you're not going to dethrone Josie Altidore, that's always going to be in your mind. And it's a tough way to kind of make that jump. When you always know in the back of your mind, no matter how hard you train, no matter how well, how many, you can score a million goals in training. You can come in and do as much as you can in 10-minute substitution or 15 minutes off the bench. But you can't take it to the next step if you're not playing and starting matches every weekend. To really hit that development, to really make it to the next step, you need to be playing minutes. You need to be playing consistent minutes every weekend to take your game to the next level. And it's very difficult for a player in Akinyola's position to do that. Now, I know he has talent because I've seen it in spurts, you know, throughout games and minutes where he's played. You're like, wow, he has something special. But in order to really see it, he's got to be playing 90 minutes every weekend.
Charlie, you don't think Josie goes to Greg Vanney and he's like, hey, man, this kid deserves like 90. Yeah. You can take me out.
I'd say, Vanney, this kid, he's got something in like 5, 7, 8 years down the road.
Let me check my retirement timeline. Yeah, and that's exactly. Where you can start.
Give us a third name, Doyle, and then we'll hit the mailbag. There's an Andrew in Brooklyn question that we should probably get to.
Oh, boy. He sounds disreputable. Yes. I'm going to name Diego Palacios, the left back for LAFC. He's been good. They signed him last summer. He's been good. He hasn't been incredible. But it's less about him as a player and more about what he represents, because from in 2018-19, he played with Willem Twee in the Eredivisie. He was considered the best young left back in the Eredivisie. And there Ajax, PSV, there were rumors of Barcelona, though I'm not sure how much I believe those. But this was a kid with a very European profile. He's from South America. He's Ecuadorian. Certainly the biggest teams in South America knew about him as well. LAFC were able to sign him. And the fact that LAFC are now competing for and signing players like this, it kind of blows me away. Now, whether you consider him a prospect still, he has over 3,000 first division minutes, but they also signed a midfielder from Ecuador who kind of fits that same bill in Jose Cifuentes. He was one of the stars for the Ecuadorian national team, the U20 team that last year made it all the way to the quarterfinals of the U20 World Cup, beat the U.S. He scored a banger of a goal against the U.S. And this is a kid who played for a well-known Ecuadorian team. And there was interest reportedly from River Plate, Boca Juniors, a couple of Brazilian teams, and teams in the Dutch Eredivisie. He signed with LAFC. So it's less about the players themselves, and it's more about the understanding of where MLS teams are competing and who they're competing against to sign the best young players in the world. LAFC has kind of showed that if the developmental plan is right and if the money is right, MLS teams can go out and compete with Ajax and PSV and sign these players and develop them. And I think that is just huge.
Does that surprise you that it's Thorington and Bob Bradley getting the job done and identifying them, but also convincing them to sign for LAFC?
I mean, it surprises me that it's taken taken someone in MLS this long. And it makes me happy that someone's finally doing it. And I look forward to seeing what is going to happen, because they kind of already have done it, though it needs to be said, Atuesta and Diego Rossi were not considered the same level of prospect that Palacios and Cifuentes and Guinella all are. So it's, and Brian Rodriguez, of course, as well, who I don't consider a prospect anymore. He has 5,000 first division minutes.
Doyle, would it matter to you if Palacios didn't have a great time at LAFC and they sold him for profit? Like, does he have to produce in MLS to make this worthwhile? Because it's all about the transfer.
I mean, if they make a profit off of him, then it's.
But that means he's. That means if they're making a hefty transfer, that means he's doing it in MLS. That means he's performing well. You're not selling him for if he's not bringing his A game to.
That's MLS not matches. Always true. Alfonso Davies was good in MLS. He wasn't $25 million worth. Like, there are moments in MLS history where you've had guys who are prospects who don't always perform at their highest level here.
He performed at his highest level here for Vancouver. He performed. Fair.
I think Davies was probably a bad example.
Carlos was like borderline top five defensive midfielder in MLS. Borderline. And he got sold for $4.5 million to Augsburg, and he's a starter in the Bundesliga now. So, like, you don't have to blow everything away to make this type of move if you already have the profile. And that's the thing with Palacios and Cifuentes and Guinella. They already have the profile. I suspect LAFC is going to do a good bit of business off of these guys. And it's exciting to me. Again, it's just exciting to see where MLS teams are competing in the global transfer.
This goes to what you were saying about institutional knowledge, Dave, with Toronto FC. And kind of what you said there, Doyle, with why didn't some other team do it? Well, it's because I think it's because you have to build up that institutional knowledge, whether that's your scouting networks, whether that's convincing ownership to spend the amount of money that it takes to bring in a Brian Rodriguez, a Janela, like all at once, whether it's the rules having those open. Like, to me, it's been a gradual march toward this. And somebody was going to have to be the first team to really do it en masse. And now LAFC is going to have to be the first team to do it en masse in terms of selling. And that's yet another bit of institutional knowledge that so far, do they have it? We don't know.
But also, is there a coach in MLS history who was going to compete at a level that Bob's teams compete at and really give a shot to a young international player who isn't proven? And in Bob's case, he's in the room with Thorington making this decision. And we've had coaches who have been in that spot before, like Bruce and Ziggy, who were not going to take that risk because they didn't want that guy. And then you've had other GMs who wanted to take that risk, but knew their coaches wouldn't play them. So there was no point in it. So you mentioned institutional knowledge, but like you have a guy probably in the one scenario. If Bob makes it work, then you're going to see other teams do it. And I think Dallas is going to try it because you've got a GM coming from Brazil and this is what you're trying.
Oscar Brea
has done it. Yeah, that's true. Fabian Castillo is a good example, but maybe not the pressure on Pareja to win like Bruce had in LA or whatever else, but you haven't had a guy who will try it. I don't know about Frank. I don't know anything about Frank DeBoer at this point.
I would expect DeBoer to play guys. No matter how old they are or where they come from.
But
But I also think DeBoer, and I'm not saying Bob wouldn't do this, but I think DeBoer will look at it and say, who gives me the best chance to win on Sunday? And that's the guy I'm going to play. And Palacios and maybe Atuesta at the beginning may not have always been the answer to that. I think Bob was going to give them a chance because he believed in the team as a group. And a system where DeBoer, and this is just based off last year, it's going to be the first year. I think it's more, I need to get results now, which is, I think, the trend in history for MLS.
Yeah, it takes an innovator. It takes somebody willing to take chances. It does take the institutional knowledge that Bob has built up over, 30 plus years in the pro game and more beyond that. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. We've killed a lot of time. I could have gone through your entire list, Doyle. Maybe we'll go through another couple on Thursday's show.
All the names that flooded to my head as Doyle, like, said Pepe and then started them. I was like, oh yeah, this is a thing we talk about and know about.
We could just do an hour and a half on FC Dallas. I mean, Tanner Tessman, your favorite guy, Brian Reynolds.
Get out of here.
Maybe. Future star.
My cue. Andrew in Brooklyn hit us up in the mailbag 401-206-0MLS. We're not going to talk about this today because we're just running out of time and it's Memorial Day, but I want to know what the people at home think about the U.S. national team and an identity. Because you have Zach Steffen telling Herc a month ago at ESPN FC that the U.S. doesn't have one. Then Greg Berhalter said, okay, maybe that's fair, but we haven't had the opportunity. Now Weston McKinney's coming back out on banter with Taylor Twellman saying, yes, we do too have an identity. So I'm curious what you think at home. Does the U.S. have one? How do they get one? And how might the pandemic affect everything? 401-206-0MLS. Extra time at MLSsoccer.com. Let's get out of here. Enjoy the day with our families, whatever.
I would just say, I think we all know that having a podcast is number one for identity, and Charlie Davies now hosting the new U.S. soccer podcast. So they are on the pathway to an extra time level identity, which is all that matters. Charlie, do you want to plug?
You know what? You guys are just top. This is it. I don't have to say anything else. You know,
I'll expect my Cape Cod invitation coming up. Right?
That was very real politique from Dave there. Adios, everybody. Yeah. Enjoy your holiday. We'll see you on Thursday.